the kind of work we do when we believe in ourselves is we rebuild trust in society. If people can see you out there and you feel to them like somebody somewhat like them for whatever reason, now they trust themselves a little more. But also, I think as we have our voices and our platform, we're weaving back the trust that's being broken all around us every day. When we get the right voices to the table and we get the right messages being heard, that's the work, really. The reason I feel so committed to this work is we have to do this in order to offset all the crazy ass stuff that's happening out there that's breaking trust right, left, and center. And that's what I care most about.
Welcome to How Women Inspire, where women lead, invest, and give. I'm your host, Julie Castro-Abrams, founder and CEO of How Women Lead and managing partner of the venture firm How Women Invest. Feminist, social justice warrior, mother, friend of 50,000 plus badass women, and an expert at helping top executive women get on boards and break down barriers for women entrepreneurs, investors, and social impact activists. In this podcast, we interview women influencers and leaders from across the globe who are in the C-suite, founding companies, investing, and agents of change. We'll share stories of how women lead. We'll provide insights and data, tips you can put into action, and get to know the women who have fiercely and unabashedly stepped into their power in leadership and opened doors for other women like you. We discuss topics ranging from the journey of getting a board seat, how we can counter cultural frameworks that change the way the world views women leaders, what we're doing to close the gender funding gap, and driving equity for women in all aspects of life and career. My goal is that after every episode, you walk away feeling inspired, unstoppable, ready to level up and step into your power and influence. I want to break down the cultural narratives that hold us back collectively and those messy messages you heard that are taking up way too much of your brain space. I want you to know you're invited in, because I know that together we can change the culture, change opportunities, and create the future we want for our daughters and sisters and friends. This is our time. Are you in? Welcome to How Women Inspire. You're in for a treat today because you get to meet Denise Brosseau, who is a thought leader. Truly, a lot of people say thought leader, but this woman is the thought leader of thought leaders. She is the CEO of Thought Leadership Lab, and she's written a bunch of books, and she is just an extraordinary speaker all around the globe. We're so lucky to have her here today. She's passionate about inspiring and amplifying voices, your voice and my voice. She assists leaders and change makers in expanding their influence and their impact, which obviously is all of our goals in our communication, but really getting honed in and making sure we keep going back to that is really critical. She's literally one of my sheroes, and I've learned so much from all the impact she's had in the world. She was the founder, co-founder of Watermark, which is now called Upward, and as well as Springboard Enterprises. Denise is such a champion of women. All kinds of women-led companies and their access to capital have been front and center in the work that she does. You may already know about Denise because her reputation precedes her, but she is the real deal. When you want to find women who do things right and inspire and do it with values for other women, she's your gal. Her book, Ready to Be a Thought Leader, guides you in amplifying your message. It really helps you figure out how you can have an impact with your message and get it out there. She's been recognized as a White House champion for change. What about that? And a Silicon Valley Women of Influence. And she's got all the good degrees from Stanford and Wellesley, the women's school. Denise, I am so excited to have you here with us today because you are the queen of inspiration.
Well, I am so happy to be here, Julie. You are one of my sheroes, so this is quite fun to be together.
Okay, good. Well, we're going to have a party today then. All right, let's just start with something fun. You can call your walk-on song or that song that you need to play when times are tough or when you want to celebrate. But do you have a song that you want to claim is your favorite?
You know, the only thing that's embarrassing is how old this song is, because I think I've been listening to it a long, long time. It's, you know, it's the Helen Reddy song.
Well, it doesn't sound old to me.
it's one of those epic songs that inspires me, energizes me. And I think we still need to hear more women roar, don't you?
Absolutely. As you know, one of our credos at How Women Lead is to be unabashedly visible. I mean, you are the, I don't call it poster child, but you are the author of that, if you will. So you've helped so many women roar in the world. How did you get to a point where this became your life's work and where you felt like this is where you wanted to put your energy? Because you could do anything. You've done so many things.
I do have a very eclectic background. And I think that's actually one of the joys of looking back at my, you know, I don't have one of those resumes that reads straight line like my sister's, but I do like to try lots of new things. But if you look at the underlying story, so much of my commitment has been more women leaders at the table, more women leaders' voices. And I think it began at Wellesley, if it didn't begin at home with a strong mom and two older sisters. And, you know, but Wellesley is one of those places, you know, the motto is not to be ministered unto, but to minister, which of course they say in Latin. But, you know, it's really all about how can we be of service? How can we bring our highest and best selves to the work? And for me, the work has always been getting more women to have their voices heard.
Well, you know, people often talk about the women who are in the biggest leadership roles around the country went to all-girls colleges, all-women colleges. And I've always wondered sort of what was the secret sauce that really created that environment? I mean, certainly I've heard it's women are allowed to speak. They're allowed to take up space. You know, they're not hushed, which I kind of in most of our lives has been one of the biggest cultural problems that we all experience. So maybe it was that cultural oasis. Tell me, what about Wellesley do you think was sort of the magic?
I think it's oasis in many ways. First of all, it's an absolutely beautiful, beautiful campus. So it's lovely to be there. But more importantly, everyone you see doing important things are women. Right? The president of Wellesley's always been a woman. More than 50% of the professors are women. All the alumni are women, and the alumni are doing incredible stuff. And I remember my freshman roommate, who I'm still close friends with, you know, we would laughingly sit in the cafeteria, in the dining hall, they called it, and we would frequently have visitors who were alums who were coming to campus for a reunion or a class meeting or whatever. And we would, of course, call them the old biddies. Now I would be one of those old biddies, right? Sitting in there. And we would talk with them because they'd sit at our tables and we'd like hear. And they'd have these incredible stories. And we'd always think, like, someday we're going to be them. And that's what I think it is. If you're constantly seeing women who've opened every door, who've done anything and everything they wanted to, you think, well, I can do that, right? There's no thought that that's for them. It's for us. It's for anyone who chooses, and we choose, right? And that's what I think is the magic.
You know, I can't tell you how many people say to me, yeah, Denise helped me architect my message and my story. You've infected so many women out there. What are the core, I know you shouldn't give away the complete farm, but what are the core elements or core messages you want women to know about getting their message out there and why it's important?
Wow. I think it begins with knowing that you matter and trusting that you matter, that the more we have our voices and our ideas at the table, the more possibilities there are for the next generation, the more possibilities there are for making the change that matters to us, leaving that legacy, but also holding the baton for our time and then passing it back to the next group and bring it like you do, you know, bringing that next group along. So much of my work has been both on the entrepreneurial side and on the thought leadership side has been about helping women crystallize the kernel of what really matters to them and that purpose message, that entrepreneurial vision, and really believing that that voice matters and then crystallizing in a way that enrolls other people in getting on board. Like that this isn't just me, 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 and it's not just a big idea, but instead it's where will this take people? What's the what if future that you envision? So I always begin with what's that place you want to play, that niche, whatever you want to call it, that arena, that playing field that you want to play on. And then secondly, what is the future that you envision? What's that? What if it could be X? And when I can get people to kind of hone in on those two things, then a lot more things become possible. Then we work on the actual steps and the message. What is the change they want to bring about? What's the work that they're doing? But we have to start with you can't play in every arena, right? And you have to imagine a future that others can see with and come with you to create.
Do you see there's a pattern of what people come to when, like, the challenges that they experience when they go through this work? Because sounds a little easy, but I've done enough work with women leaders to know that that's not easy to get to what you just said.
No, it's the work, right? I mean, that's what's so fun about it for me, because having done it now for many, many, many years, I can hear it. Like, I can hear it in their voice. I can hear it because what changes is, it's like the tone of voice changes, the energy changes, the passion comes out when you really get and hone to that nub. It's trusting themselves to speak it aloud, because they've been told, like you said, there's so many of us have been told, it doesn't matter, your ideas are stupid, but sit down and shut up and sit over in that corner, nobody wants to hear from you, don't get too big from your britches, all of the, what I call the itty bitty shitty committee that we heard, external and internal, that really, but once you can peel away some of those and really listen to what people care about, it's like watching a light bulb light up. And it's one of the reasons I have a light bulb as my logo, because I do think that's what happens. It's like you see that light bulb shine and you realize they have a possibility now of making change because they've gotten to that place that matters most, where they're passionate and committed.
You know, I feel teary-eyed when I hear you say that, because so many women I know, that's their story, and myself included. Like, people look at me, I think, and think, oh, she's always been a public speaker. She's so confident. She doesn't have any issues. Every single word that just came out of your mouth, I've heard all of that and I internalized it. And even to this day, I will rely pretty heavily on my team, because I'm like, they don't want to hear what I have to say. Who cares? I write articles for Forbes, but I have got to get a lot of support, because I don't trust that what I have to say is enough. Is good enough. And I think, and what cost that is to society, what a loss.
Completely.
Right?
Completely. Right. Yes. Right. And it does come down to that word trust that you mentioned, though. And that's really so much the core of my work, because for me, it is A, trusting ourselves, but B, the kind of work we do when we believe in ourselves is we rebuild trust in society. If people can see you out there and you feel to them like somebody somewhat like them for whatever reason, now they trust themselves a little more. But also, I think as we have our voices and our platform, we're weaving back the trust that's being broken all around us every day. When we get the right voices to the table and we get the right messages being heard, that's the work, really. The reason I feel so committed to this work is we have to do this in order to offset all the crazy ass stuff that's happening out there. It's breaking trust right, left, and center. And that's what I care most about.
Well, and I wish, okay, I have a social work and executive coaching degrees. You know, I work a lot with people in their own internal stuff. And I wish it was a one and done. But unfortunately, you know, as you go through life, you think you got it. You think you did Denise's like class and you know, and then 10 years later, some new situation arises, some new vulnerability, and that old story can creep back in. Do people just come back to you 10 years later? Do they have tools that they develop where they can tackle it themselves? Have you seen the life, a couple decades of someone's experience? You've been doing this for a minute.
I've been doing this for a minute. And the truth is, I do have clients who come back.
Yeah.
And part of it is that what they say to me is that I make them push to be bigger in the world.
Yeah.
They need that push periodically. So yes, some of it is peeling away those old voices and those old styles of approaches and perspectives. But some of it is even an invitation into thinking bigger. And that's what I like to do. Yes, we need to do all that work to clear out the old, but it's also invite us to think, let's play on a bigger playing field. Let's think about what we could do if we believed that future was possible. So it's reminding. And I just was on the phone just yesterday with a client that I hadn't talked to in 2 years. And this was some of the terms and voice, the message that she was reminding me that I'd said to her. And I think that's really lovely, like to be able to reconnect with someone 2 years later or 5 years later or 10 years later and help them to remember what they had committed to. And now they're even further and now they can do even bigger things.
Yeah. So Watermark. I think of Watermark as so many elements were similar to what How Women Lead is. And I learned so much. I loved the Watermark events when you were running it, and I would go and, but you put women on stage and then you deeply saw people, I think, and connected them. And that's what's so beautiful, right? But you've seen so many women on stage and you've helped so many women with their thought leadership. I would love to know sort of what are the elements that really make someone really get it and take it in a home run? And what's your favorite story? Maybe you can tell a story to get us to understand it.
So often it's something deeply personal. So I'll pick a story that just came to mind as you asked me. And this is woman, Megan McNeely, who I met, I don't know, now 7 or 8 years ago. And she came to me through a talk that I had given at her company. And she came to me sort of, she's never going to be a quiet person. So she's bold and she's got a big personality, but she had never used it outside of work, meaning not for her own message. But she had gone through cancer 3 times in her life and had recovered each time. And she had reconfigured her entire life, really, from core elements, food and environment and stress and everything. And she had a perspective about what people needed to do. And as we started to work together, we started to put together this beautiful framework that she, it turns out her boyfriend was a graphic designer, and we worked with him to come up with this beautiful image. She ended up writing this book, interviewing some of the top leaders and that people you and I have heard of, to actually take each one of the parts of her framework and get a true story of someone talking about how reframing that part for them had changed their life. For me, it was sleep. She actually interviewed me about sleep, which was fun because I'm still struggling with it. And that was actually the joy of that book, is that she brought together those stories, but she took herself out of her role as a private wealth manager to becoming someone who was this truly passionate, committed person, because it's almost like, and I think this is true for many, like they see the light in some particular area, or they're mad as hell in some particular area, yeah, or they struggled so hard to find their way forward in some particular area that they kind of want to help the next group. And I think that's the best motivation. I wrote my own book to my younger self, because I wish when I was running my organization, you know, in my 30s, I wish I'd known what I know now about the importance of thought leadership and the journey of thought leadership. So I wrote to that younger self, here's what you could have known and what you could have done. And so I think that's where it comes. So it's either that younger self, or it's that, oh, I just wish I knew this. Can I help other people go faster, better, more easily?
Well, thank you, because I have a daughter and I hadn't thought about giving her this book, but I think she's ready. She's 30 and she needs to read it. So thank you very much.
Oh, please do.
Giving that gift to the world.
Thank you.
So what's next for you? Where are you going with your impact on the world?
So I've been thinking deeply about a new topic, very related to my old topic, but somewhat bigger, in, again, thinking bigger. So my work up until recently was thought leaders as individuals. And when I originally wrote the book, it was about becoming an individual thought leader in that journey. But I got the chance a couple of years ago to create a course for LinkedIn Learning on being a thought leader, becoming a thought leader, I think it's called. And then they asked me if I would do a second course. And I didn't have a second book, but I decided to do a course on thought leading organizations, like what can organizations do to be thought leaders? And so honestly, there weren't a lot of organizations a few years ago, really before COVID, really doing much in this arena. That was just, you know, a couple. Patagonia certainly comes to mind, but we saw a lot of shifts since COVID, and we've seen a lot of change since Black Lives Matter and all of the different things that have changed at the importance of companies and organizations coming forward and using their voice and their platform, as well as the pushback against woke companies. So here's what I've been thinking about for the last several months. I've been interviewing people in lots of different walks of life about what is our role and responsibility as a board member? What is our role and responsibility as the leader of an organization in using our voice and platform? And how does it play to my perspective on trust, which I think is really the core of thought leadership work? But also, how does it play and tie into moral leadership and rebuilding the moral leadership of our country?
Right.
So that's what I'm working on. I'm trying to come up with a talk. I don't think I'm ready to write another book, but I want to do a talk. And so I'm learning the most amazing, I'm really interviewing some fascinating people and learning some amazing things about how people look at this. and it's not that clear.
Well, thank you, because I think you know enough about me to know this is sort of my core, you know, of what I think about. And I've dedicated my life to making the world a better place. But really, it's about justice and equity and poverty alleviation at the core. And one of the things I see, and it makes me so sad, is, and even I'm working with my kids on this, right? It's so often we glorify in this country making a lot of money, right? Nothing wrong with having money and making money. But if you lose your moral center, it costs you in ways you cannot begin to quantify. And if you, I'll just say for myself, I literally every single thing I've done in my life, in my career, has been help other people and make a positive impact on the world. And boy, I can tell the peace that I have inside of me because of that. Now, that doesn't mean I may or may not have it shown up in my leadership every single second, but it's certainly in the core. So when you think about intent versus impact, and you think about elements of moral leadership, you said the word courage. And I do think about, there was a huge backlash, I think, to some organizations that didn't take a stand around Roe versus Wade, and the Dobbs decision, or that people who had sort of big responses big responses to the George Floyd murder. And I'm sorry, I'm just going to say it here. Andreessen Horowitz came out with an announcement. They were putting $1 million towards Black entrepreneurs. If you know how much money they invest in any single deal, that's absolutely offensive to suggest that there's anything ameliorative about that. And so, you know, I'd love your thoughts on what does that look like? And when does something seemingly moral actually be really not? I don't know. That's a big question. Answer the question of the universe, please.
Yeah, I'll get right on that. Yeah. But it is an element that I've been thinking a lot about, because when you think about companies greenwashing or coming out with these performative statements or even these performative mission statements like do no harm or we're going to connect the world's communities, but really what they're doing is gathering all kinds of data about us that then they're exploiting. As an employee of a company like that, or as someone who's a customer, I mean, it does instill cynicism in people to realize how performative some of this is and how prettifying they're doing this $1 million commitment, which is complete malarkey. That is, to me, the performative part and the greenwashing part and all of the good for the sake of looking good versus actually doing good is actually more harmful in some ways than just shutting up. And so I would prefer a company who isn't going to completely live values instead of just speak values to stop talking and leave more room for others. But the problem is that it is very, I don't know, the word would be sexy at the moment of George Floyd to suddenly come out with your, I'm going to do X, Y, Z, or the Dobbs decision. I'm going to do, you know, we get on the bandwagon very quickly. But what we've seen and the data shows is that when a company does that, but they don't live up to it, they actually not just break trust with their own employees, but they break trust with future employees, with all the stakeholders that are playing. So yeah, it is fundamentally more harmful. And I'm not sure I think I went in a circle on this, but I do think it's fundamentally more harmful. And it's all the more important why the rest of us need to be paying attention and living the values, not just speaking the values.
Well, and doing it for the right reasons, not for all of the other, frankly,
looking sexy,
you know, but yeah, which is challenging. So I do all the corporate governance work, and you know, there has been some pretty clear research saying CEOs that come out and make a statement about a moral issue or a position, that it actually ends up generally backlashing and there's some backlash, and it doesn't actually help the company. And if you know that, and you know you're not going to make everybody happy when you take a stand on the Dobbs decision, for example, where, and maybe this is a bigger thing than you want to tackle here, but, and you know, like right now, the Fearless Fund has gotten the people who brought the Harvard admissions to the Supreme Court, the law firm, they're now suing people all across the country that are giving grants to people of color or naming who it's for. And
you can only laugh because it's so absurd. I mean, the amount of impact, unfortunately, that the Fearless Fund can actually have is so small.
They're little $20,000 grants to Black entrepreneurs. Like, really? How much money, right? To me, it's like, are you freaking kidding me? What a waste. But if you are running a small organization doing grants, the risk of you getting sued by this huge institution that just won in the Supreme Court, it's very scary.
Yes.
So I think all over the place, you have a responsibility as a moral leader, but you also have a responsibility to keep your company safe. So it's sort of an interest. How do people wrestle with that conundrum and stand in what's right? You know, as always, of course, the courage.
Well, it goes in my mind to one of the essential elements of thought leadership, that thought leadership is about one to many, many to many, right? That as a leader, we're trying to influence the people we have direct impact to. Thought leaders are trying to get those who we're connected to impact others. So here's what we're trying to do in a situation where we're trying to allow for other voices to be heard. We have to stand arm in arm in conjunction with people like the Fearless Fund. And I am seeing groups like yours and others that I trust and respect saying, stop and enough. This is, you know, I'm signing petitions and calling these folks out in the media. And I think that is the moral responsibility of leadership, that a small entity like the Fearless Fund and others like them simply can't be fighting this by themselves. And it's hard enough just doing the work that they're doing. But the responsibility is then to use their voice responsibility is to use their voice on behalf of these folks who are getting attacked, whether it's the anti-woke Republicans or whether it's the, you know, anti-affirmative action.
The anti-antis of everything. Again,
anti-good.
What are you for?
You know, I've spent my whole career, I wrote a post a couple months ago. I spent my entire career working on abortion rights. Like, that's my cause. I've been working on it for 30 plus years, right? This is so hard to do this work. And I was just literally working on this issue exactly yesterday, writing 50 letters to people to say, please give this year, please come to the event this year, blah, blah, blah.
I got one of those.
I'm glad. And a year ago, when the Dobbs decision came out, I have to say, I stopped for a couple months. I was depressed, demoralized. And what I wrote the post about is that this same feeling had happened to me about 10 years before that, when I had been working for so many years on women's access to capital. I started working on it in my 30s. I worked on it and worked on it and worked on it. And then I had a moment after one of the economic crashes in which so many of the venture capitalists removed women CEOs from their roles as the leader of their company. And I felt like all my hard work was for naught. And I had felt like after pushing this idea of venture capital and building women's knowledge and expertise and raising venture capital, I literally stopped. I have yet to advise another woman to raise venture capital since that time because if I talk to them about it because they want to, I only spend my time working on it. And here's the thing to worry about. And here's the thing to prevent. And here's why you need a lawyer. And like, I'm working on all the risks, which I didn't really talk about so much. And I kind of stopped my life's work on women and access to capital, which is why I'm glad you picked it up and carried it forward. But I was determined this time, when that same sort of feeling of disillusionment and despair came over me, I was determined not to stop this time, and that this work is too important, that there are fortunately others picking up the baton like you are on women's access to capital. And I love all the things that you guys are doing. It's like amazing. So more forward thinking than we did when we first started this work in the 90s. And the abortion work is all the more important because we can't ever get to the point of raising venture capital if we have babies without any sense of control over that. Like, so I will continue to do this work. I will continue to fight the fight. I will continue to carry the baton until I die, I suspect, on this one, because this is the core fundamental of everything for women. Like, we don't have control of our bodies and our choice of when to be parents. We don't have control of anything.
Amen. One of my very first jobs was at the Illinois Pro-Choice Alliance and, you know, going and exposing those fake pregnancy centers that were, you know, scaring.
We're still right down the road here in California.
Denise, anyone listening to this, I know you must have your heart so full of just your authentic sharing of the things that have been important to you and how frustrating it can be sometimes, a couple steps forward and, you know, one step forward, two steps back. But I just want to say thank you to you. You and I are completely aligned in everything we've ever done. If you look at what we've done, so much of it is like, you know, yes, 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 yes. And what a gift to get to spend time with you today. You are so special and so beloved. And I hope you really sit back and feel in your bones all the impact you've had on the world. And I cannot wait to see the combination of this, what you come up with about moral leadership, because that's, I want to be better every day. That's my goal, is to be a moral leader. And yeah, I look forward to learning more from you than I already have. So how can people find you, Denise?
My website, thoughtleadershiplab.com, or please invite people to connect with me on LinkedIn. That's where I share all my content and my ideas. And I'd love to hear from people.
And if you work with groups or individuals, if somebody needs to do this work themselves?
I work with both. I work with individuals, primarily senior women leaders, on that journey from leader to thought leader. But I also work with teams and organizations as both as an executive coach and a thought leadership consultant. I think the work is still so important, and I intend to commit to doing this for a while yet. And I love this opportunity to be involved with your community going forward. So thank you, Julie. It's always a pleasure.
Well, thank you. Thank you for joining us today. And thank you for inspiring all of us. You're why I do this work. So thank you, my sister. Everybody have a wonderful day. And I hope that before you go on to your next thing, that you take a couple minutes and you think about the impact you want to have on the world. And are there stories that are stopping you from getting your voice out there fully and authentically? These are all such beautiful things that we all need to be keep wrestling with throughout our lives. It's not a one and done thing. So thanks, my friends. We need your voice.
Thank you, Julie.
And with that, I want to thank you all for listening to today's episode of How Women Inspire. And because your inspiration should not stop when this podcast ends, head over to our website, howwomenlead.com. Follow us on LinkedIn at How Women Lead and subscribe or follow on your favorite podcast app to find out how you can proactively take charge and step into your power through our workshops and activism. In our loving network, we want to propel you. See you next time, ladies. And remember to be unabashedly visible.